If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Captain! Captain! Signatures detected!
Shields up!
Signatures detected!
Red alert!
Context Starfleet Command!
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command!
Delay that order!
Context Starfleet Command!
This is the captain!
Context Starfleet Command!
Get out of my chair! Chair!
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
I was really looking forward to this episode.
Yeah.
Not that I don't look forward to them all. I love them all equally, like they're my children.
Mm-hmm.
The only children I'll be having are these shows.
Wow.
But I think one thing that this show has done well is build some suspense. Like, I am really interested in what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Even though I'm often disappointed at what has just happened. Like, it's sort of the weird, like, it's the sex thing of tell me what you're going to do, disappoint me during, and then get me excited about what's going to happen later.
Yeah. That's the secret to a lasting sexual relationship.
Yeah. That's how I'm feeling about it at the moment.
Don't spice it up. Spice it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I'm wanting to know what happens next. I was not disappointed at the last episode, so I was, feeling optimistic about this one. Feeling so optimistic that I'm trying to get into a patter where I speak like I'm in Discovery. Don't go any further. Don't do this.
If I can only talk to him face to face.
Yeah.
Press my face up to his glass. Then he'll see how sincere I'm being.
But then I'll move my face along the glass and make that rubbing noise. No one likes that. No one likes that.
If I wanted to destroy the shuttle, I'll just rub my face on the glass like this. That's nice.
Boy, a Star Trek Voyager amount of shuttle danger in this episode.
We don't usually talk about the show as much as we have in the Marin. I think that's because I just really want to get into the show.
Okay, we could just get into it.
Let's just get into the show, man.
Nothing holding us back, baby.
Yeah, I need to talk about this one with you.
Okay.
I've got some thoughts about Star Trek Discovery Season 4, Episode 9, Rubicon. Rubicon, famously the longer, bigger Jeep Wrangler.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what they're suggesting? That's the only meaning I know of for that word.
I thought that they named this after one of the runabouts from Deep Space Nine. I just figured it was a reference to Deep Space Nine and no other things.
Had to be. Yeah.
This episode starts with a very tense scene of building the bomb. Nobody set them up the bomb. They got to do it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, we live in a distant future where you've got stuff like programmable matter. But you also live in a universe where you're handling an explosive material with manual tongs and like filling up a pepper mill with it without getting the peppercorns all over your counter.
Yeah. I've never not spilled peppercorns all over my counter. Never once.
That's what I'm saying. You know what? The greatest leap in science fiction the show has ever taken is that neither Book nor Tarka are doing like bowl hands around the top of the thing they're filling.
Trying to make a funnel out of their two hands kind of cupped together.
Hey, here's another free item for the merch table, Ben. Isolinium peppercorns. Ooh, they're spicy. That's a spicy peppercorn.
Ooh, Szechuan isolinium. Yeah. Nice.
Right?
You have, I think the fanciest thing either of us owns is the pepper mill that you recently bought.
Yeah.
I would love to get a Greatest Gen branded version of that pepper mill. Do you think there's a white label edition of that that we could get into podshop.biz?
I don't think there is. This was one of those late night drunk Kickstarter purchases I made like years ago. Yeah. Seriously, this is one of those ones where you think the Kickstarter is going to fail to launch and you're just out.
Right.
But then this is how it happens. Like you aren't paying attention and then you start getting the notifications like, hey, we're actually going to build this thing. Thanks. And then when it came, the pepper mill that I got is every bit what they promised.
Wow.
It's the...
Yeah.
If you're curious.
That's what it's called. That's the name of the product?
Yeah. Which we should bleep out because...
Because they haven't supported the show?
Right. Exactly. But this thing, the blast pattern on the pepper, on the grind, is amazing. It's the best.
It's really, really impressive.
And it doubles as a home defense weapon. It's really thick.
Yeah. Almost as impressive as this prop. I acknowledge that there's some silliness in the use of forceps to install the dish full of peppercorns into the programmable matter remainder of the bomb. But I loved the tension in the scene. I love like Tarka licking his lips while he's doing it.
It's a weird A to B because like we're in this scene where everyone's being very careful about filling the isolytic pepper mill.
Mm-hmm.
But then Book is like, Tarka, what the fuck, man? Work faster. Like, get this thing done. Are we done yet?
Yeah. I also like that they chose, like, the one table that we've seen in the deep future that actually has physical legs and isn't just floating there. Like,
right.
We're not going to risk one of these hover tables for a job this delicate.
We're going classic table this time. With a couple of sugar packets under one of the legs.
Table original flavor.
Yeah, yeah.
Book has left a hollow voicemail for Michael Burnham, and she calls Saru into her quarters. She's like, can you fucking believe this guy broke up with me over hollow voicemail? Who does that? What the fuck?
Avoided the opportunity for comedy here when you don't get the swingers version of the bad repeated hollow voicemail situation where Book's just trying to re-record a better version than the one that came before and can't delete them.
Don't ever call me again.
Yeah, he is basically saying there will be no middle ground. We're not going to see eye to eye on this and I've got to go do this. I'm really sorry this has come between us, and goodbye.
Yeah. Saru is like, well, we have no choice but to elevate my character back into its previous rightful place as number two star of the show.
Yeah.
Right, MB?
That won't happen.
She's like, high five. I mean, ooh, let's do low five out of frame.
Yuck.
So Michael Burnham has a briefing with Admiral Final Opponent in a movie about a chess tournament.
Mm.
And he says, you're going to have to go after Book. And this time we're putting a leash on you.
Yeah.
We're not just letting fly off the handle. Fuck the mission. Michael Burnham do this one solo. Not when she's this close to the case.
I'm pretty sure this is when you open up Final Draft, it'll give you a template for this scene where an authority figure like Admiral Clinical Strength Antiperspirant Commercial Model asks a subordinate, if you just aren't too close to this mission and maybe it shouldn't be you on this. Like, you just change the names
right. In
the template.
Yeah.
And this gives you the scene.
Final Draft will do the rest.
Right. The one little alt to this is that he's going to attach an officer chaperone to kind of backstop the emotions of this mission. If Burnham were to go on it, and Burnham is still very interested in doing so.
Right. And the officer in question is Officer Nan, who's now a commander in Starfleet security. She's upgraded her face gadgets. Her eyes are back to the way that she wants them to be.
Yeah.
She's got some highlights. She's a whole new Nan.
It seems like that's how it is on Discovery for the actors. Is like, you start with an Arium or a Nan amount of appliances, and then you graduate into taking those things off.
Do you think Doug Jones heard that this actress was coming back, and he's like, oh, cool, somebody else that's going to have a ton of loaf in the episode, and then he sees what she's in when she walks out in her costume, and he's like, what the fuck? Come on! Oh!
Doug Jones is like, you know, I could use a few more episodes where I'm magically transformed into a human. That was pretty cool.
That would be great.
I think there's a lot of story meat left on that bone.
I really liked my character being able to breathe through his nose.
Yeah. The seed vault mission is over, I guess. All of those seeds got planted.
Yeah.
Or something. Or she captained the seed ship back to where it needed to go.
Yeah, that was like a rotating position, right? She got maybe she got swapped out. She's been doing some soldiering. She talks about doing like mop up on the Emerald Chain.
There's a pretty fun I like how this conversation goes, because it's like hugs and high fives and a happy reunion again. And poor Michael Burnham asks the question that is the landmine in the conversation, which is like, so how's your family? I know that a big part of your whole deal was going to catch up with them. And like the temperature drops in the room completely.
Yeah.
Nan does not want to talk about this.
Do not love having a conversation with somebody where suddenly they reveal that you've gone into a previously unknown no-go zone.
Yeah. I mean, this happens to us all the time where we'll get on the mics and you'll just ask how I'm doing.
The real answer is I'm doing shitty.
And then just like all the air comes out of the room. Like, what have you done, Ben? Yeah. How does this uncomplicate things again? Because the Admiral's like, look, I don't know if I can trust you and all of your pesky emotions. So instead, I'm going to stick you with an old friend with a history of her own in order to maybe play out some sort of conflict in front of a bridge crew later where people might have to take some sides.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just guessing that might happen.
Yeah, I think that one big problem with this episode is the connective tissue between this scene and the scene where they walk onto the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Yeah.
But I do like the idea that Nan is a character that we can draw on in special moments like this. And
yeah,
I think that they try to justify it by saying like, oh yeah, Barzans are like all about the mission.
Uh-huh.
They're like unquestioning soldiers. And like, damn, dude, you're kind of stereotyping her entire people right in front of her face. What's that about?
Yeah. I mean, her code is what we need as a viewer, though, to appreciate the choice that the Admiral makes.
Yes, so. We cut down to Saru's quarters, where he has regrown all his plants after the Everything is on Fire mission a few episodes back.
Nice work, Saru. They really bounced back nicely.
Yeah, it's looking good. There's not quite as much like green matting on the walls, but everything else is looking good.
Moss grows slow, right?
I guess so, yeah. He gets a holo from President Trina, who is in a very humid space of her own, I might suggest.
Greetings, Trina. It appears as though you are holloing me from a flooded basement.
Of course.
He wants some help chilling the fuck out. Maybe you need a President Trina in your life, somebody that you can call up to let the pressure out of the system.
That sounds nice. Just someone I can sit on a cushion with.
Yeah. Do a little guided meditation. I mean, Saru is so up in his head, he can't even get through the meditation. But
you know what Saru really likes? More cushion for the meditution.
He does like that, Adam. He likes it very, very much.
Yeah. They get on down. He reaches out his fingers to Trina's hands and... why did they do this to us? Shot in profile, even.
Yeah.
Like, super hot lights.
She's like, I would not do this if this was not a hologram, Saru.
I thought they fucked with Saru's fingers in this episode. I remember them. This might just be like what the mind does to exaggerate. I thought his fingers were longer.
Oh.
I thought they were a lot longer, like an extra knuckle longer. I was shocked to see how short they were. I thought he had Arsenio Hall fingers.
Yeah, he didn't have Sarjenka fingers in this episode. Right.
Yeah.
But he does have an invitation to a hot date, Adam.
Yeah.
We knew this was coming.
I love how Vulcans seduce, you know? Would you like to take that, which is my regular walk, or the food, which is my meal, together sometime? And fucking Saru does that thing like someone who's responding to a marriage proposal. Like, not definitive.
Yeah. I'm going to have to get back to you.
I'll think about it is not a good answer.
Yeah. Kind of a slap in the face. She seems pretty cool about it.
I mean, that's because she has total grasp of her emotional faculties.
Yeah.
If she were anyone else.
Do you think she's like, I'll be on Ponfar in like a couple of weeks, so... As long as I can get this lined up in between now and then, it's going to be fine.
I don't know why I didn't think about that, Ben, but the idea that this is Ponfar time coming and a walk and a meal is instead like a room with a bunch of plastic sheets on it.
Yeah, it's going to be off the hook when Saru actually shows up for this.
Yeah.
Indeed, it will.
This is what we mean by walk and meal. Your people refer to it as tax documents.
That's sort of the Federation argument, but we haven't been part of the Federation for a long time.
That's right. Back on the bridge, we cut over to talking politics in the workplace.
Yeah.
And when Saru gets to the bridge, he has to clamp that shit down.
Reese is kind of walking around talking about how Book is probably right because the Federation is too feckless and slow to solve the DMA problem expeditiously. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of a hawk, right? Like he is like,
he is
like, how eager for the fray does Reese have to be if he's on the Disco, like the ship that does every single thing in the Federation in this timeline. And he's still like not satisfied with how much action he's seeing.
He's the Wangro of the bridge crew. He just has to get it on.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like this kind of conflict on the bridge with the mission that they have ahead. This sort of fighting out in the open.
Yeah, you could see Reese just like shooting Book's ship without anybody asking him to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Captain Burnham and Nan come on the bridge, and Nan is kind of trying to play it chill, like she's just there for a visit. Everybody's really happy to see her. But this was the other thing that I felt didn't make a lot of sense after that scene that introduced her role in the episode, which is like, wouldn't it be crucial for everyone on the bridge to know what Nan is there for before it's like the moment where she has to make an order that supersedes Michael Burnham's order?
Right.
Like, shouldn't they all be prepared for, like Michael Burnham jumps out in front of this and is like, yeah, Nan is here to like countermand me if I get too emotionally caught up in this. And everybody's like, got it. Makes a ton of sense. We have seen what Michael Burnham does in emotionally vexing situations before.
We need to be ready.
Reese is like, I thought this was going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Reese is going around the bridge collecting bet wins from... everyone.
Everyone is so happy to see Nan.
Yeah.
Even though they quickly understand what she's there to do. And then things get real serious because it's mission time. And like any coach of a sports team, Burnham reminds everyone what they're there to do, calls up the target on the screen.
Yeah.
And tells everyone what the stakes are.
The planet that they are going to is an uninhabited rogue planet. I kind of wish this had been Quajon. It kind of looks like what Quajon looked like after the DMA hit it.
Yeah, that would have added some emotional heft, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like if they were, you know, cloaked and we could only see that the Disco was there from all the bird corpses being moved out of the way as they flew closer and closer.
Detmer's like, we can only get this close. Otherwise, the density of the bird corpses becomes too thick. Also the little kids. It's mostly bird corpses and kids
that
we're dealing with.
Let's be honest, Michael Burnham. You're no Captain Sully. If this thing goes down, I'd be really worried.
I'm not sure there's enough power to reroute to the deflector dish to push this amount of dead kids and birds out of the way.
So they do a cloaked spore jump, which I don't think we've ever seen before. Looked really cool.
It's the coolest looking one.
Yeah.
They pick up Book Ship as soon as they arrive, and then Burnham calls Saru, Nan, and Culber into a private meeting.
Yeah.
You want to do this on site. You don't want to do this ahead of the trip.
Right.
You want to do this while you're there. And the plan on the table is she wants to use a cloaked shuttle. Like the cloaking technology is totally exportable now.
Yeah.
You can use it on anything.
Yeah.
They should have cloaked the tracking device.
There's no more Romulan Empire to have that constraining peace treaty with. The Federation can do whatever it wants, W/R/T cloaks.
Was the tracking device a cloaked tracking device, or was it just made of a thing that melts into what you're tracking?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Because if you can make cloaks that small,
yeah,
imagine what you could cloak.
It seems like you would be able to feel it, though, if it was just cloaked.
I'd cloak my wallet all the time. Except I'd lose my wallet.
You'd lose
all
your
the time.
Wallet.
No, that'd be a terrible idea.
Yeah, you'd want to like put one of those like tile gadgets in the wallet if you cloaked it.
Were you expecting Zora to chime in here, or Zora to attempt to stop them, or are we just not that interested in the Zora self-aware protection storyline anymore, except when it's convenient?
Well, Specialist Zora has a lot to do in this episode, but it's mostly background math computations, so
yeah,
maybe Zora's just busy.
Yeah, too busy to care.
They're going to send a shuttle to infiltrate Book's ship, and they're going to have Culber on the mission. You know, one thing that hit me in this episode is I wish Book's ship had a name. Does it not have a name?
I don't think it does. And when you watch Star Trek Discovery and take notes on it, a ship not having a name is a great inconvenience.
And it's annoying in the scenes, right? Like,
yeah.
Name the ship.
Yeah.
If anybody from the Star Trek writers' room still listens to this show, throw a name on that pup, assuming it doesn't get destroyed before you have an opportunity to.
If we haven't alienated all of our friends at Star Trek Discovery, please give it a name.
Just for our sake.
Yeah.
Call it the, I don't know, the Shimoda.
Incredible.
Oh, yeah. That's perfect.
That would be great.
This plan feels like it's straight out of a submarine movie. You drive your little mini sub up to the big sub,
mm-hmm.
and you sneak in through a torpedo tube.
Yeah, you get that hammer, and you bang it on the hull to let them know to open up the door.
Exactly. And Nan is like, this sounds like a really cool submarine movie idea. However, I do not love the idea of Michael Burnham once again leading a mission like this.
Yeah.
And Burnham's like, I'm one step ahead of you, Nan. Like, it's going to be Saru. Saru and his gross-ass fingers are going to be all up in this mission.
And get this. We don't even have to bring a hammer because he can just use his hoof against the hull when it comes time to make that banging noise.
And guess what? In case there's an argument among crew members about which side of the bomb or not bomb that we should be on, we're sending along a therapist on this away team.
There's going to be a Culber on this mission to defuse, to de-escalate when everybody is yelling at each other, which is inevitable because everybody's so mad about this situation.
Culber prescribes, Culber provides, as the saying goes.
So the little cloaked shuttle takes off, and inside the shuttle, I didn't know these shuttles had like a captain's chair option.
Yeah.
I like that Saru had like fully gone captain of the shuttle mode, which should put him in a position to shut down bickering between Reese and Bryce, who are two of the characters that disagree on the politics of the situation. But Saru is not really able to cool this down. And I was worried that Culber may have expended all of his de-escalation ordinance a little early.
That's so too.
Because he has to stop Reese and Bryce from tearing each other's heads off before they even get to Book's ship. Seems like Reese doesn't really believe in this mission. Maybe shouldn't be on the tip of the spear.
Right. I mean, because this is two scenes in a row now where we're like, whoa, Reese, chill maybe. I love Wilson Cruz for this. This is a ability that he has uniquely as an actor.
Absolutely.
I think in a lesser actor's hands, this would be silly or cheesy in a way that it is not here. Outside of just the idea of his job being involved in a very dangerous mission, like, he handles this moment capably.
I agree. I was fantasizing about having Wilson Cruz, like, resolve a conflict between you and me. How great that would be.
That'd be nice. We should bring him in sometime.
Yeah.
For, like, the big one. The big one that we know is coming.
You said it, brother.
Saru will turn this cloaked car around if they don't stop bickering. And
yeah.
And they do.
Yeah.
But but you're right. It does not feel resolved at all.
They pull up to Book's ship, and we mostly watch this on kind of wireframe representations of what's going on under cloak from the bridge of the Discovery.
All we got is the previs, guys. That's all we got. Just use it. Use the previs.
We only had 4 weeks off to get this stuff ready. I say we throw it in the episode, call it a screen visualization. It's what the sensors get or something.
Right. Yeah.
So they show the tube extending and connecting to the ship, and they're like, this is great. They don't even know we're here. But then they hear critters or something covering the shuttle. It's got bugs all over it.
This is a great audio effect. I love this sound. I love how creepy it was. Good stuff.
Yeah. Anytime you've got something on the surface of a ship, you want to get the camera low and have a character stand up while looking up at the ceiling. And they get that shot, so it really sells it.
Yeah.
And what this is a aftermarket modification that Tarka installed on Book's ship that is a theft prevention device. And Book is like, what the fuck, mate? You probably voided my warranty.
You remember when I took your ship into that tinting place? They also installed the security system. What's crazy about it is that it's completely autonomous.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do to turn it off.
Yeah.
Which is like every security system on any car that's ever been installed. No one turns it off.
Right.
Once it starts beeping. And the beeping is the worst part. Like, inside the shuttle, they're like, I am very terrified about whatever's making that sound, but it's the alarm.
It's so annoying.
God.
And it's like, it's so sensitive too. Like, all that happened was somebody drove a motorcycle by, and we just have to listen to this now?
Yeah. Tarka is kind of delighted with his own ingenuity, but Book is horrified by this. Like, he can't let his Discovery pals get killed.
Yeah, he has been pretty single-minded about destroying the DMA up to this point, but he's not so single-minded that he's going to let the team on the shuttle buy the farm for just doing their jobs. So he tries to do an EMP at Tarka's suggestion that would loosen the critters that are grabbing onto the shuttle. The shuttle is going to try and back away in coordination with this. It's touch and go. We see the shuttle start to like rip apart from the inside. And then we see from the outside, like the back half of the shuttle just like fully falls off. And then we cut to the bridge where the away team materializes all at once. And boy, what a fun save. I love the like falling into the bridge moment.
Yeah. Saru doesn't fall down though. He arrives standing up and is able to brace himself against a panel.
Yeah, he grabs Detmer's control panel, and she's like, "Ew! Get your fingers off of that!
You touched my screen, didn't you?"
He's immediately spraying it down with Purell.
Yeah. Here's a question that this moment answers. They don't have a transporter room anymore, do they? Because
I've wondered
about these
that.
Flash beamers?
Yeah.
What's too bad about that is that was one of the cool Discovery sets for the
really
first couple seasons, and now it's probably in a dumpster.
It's been made redundant.
Yeah.
And Kramer might just find it and
make
his own show.
That'd be nice.
That would be great.
Yeah, an interview show set in the transporter room.
How did you get this in here?
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
The mission is a big fat failure. They had one shot and they blew it.
You know what was a success, though? A near-death experience bringing Bryce and Reese together.
Yeah. I guess that does kind of galvanize Reese to follow orders going forward.
Yeah. Maybe that's what we need. Just more near-death experiences for you and me.
That's why we book these tours, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's already near financial death experience. That's a form of death, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've been mostly dead all day.
You know, I told our booker on the phone the other day, like, I know you've had to book this tour three times now.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that we don't have to cancel this one also.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, man, it's just the world we live in. And I was like, fuck, that is so healthy. That is such a healthy worldview.
Yeah.
He's the one that has suffered the most. Like, I mean, it sucked for us too, but like, he has had to do so much busy work booking and rebooking and rebooking this fucking tour.
All day, this is what he does. Yeah. We're like his 200th phone call of that kind. And he's fine.
He's chilling.
Good mental health.
Yeah. Enviable.
So, with the mission having failed, there is only one place Book and Tarka would go, and that is the DMA, specifically inside the DMA.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get another brief Michael Burnham speech preparing everybody for a jump into the middle of the big bad.
We were talking earlier about kind of a thankless dialogue moment and how, you know, an actor can rise to that moment.
Yeah.
When we were talking about Wilson Cruz earlier. This needle in a haystack observation by Detmer is so thankless as dialogue. So brutal. Emily Kutz does great with it, but what I don't understand is that this is a show that gives Haz Mazzaro of Haz Mazzaro's Karma Barge like eight different totally inscrutable idioms, and you give Detmer, a real character on this show who's been in every episode, needle in a haystack. Fuck out of here with that. Do better by Detmer.
Yeah. Why couldn't she have said blob of ink in an armis or something?
Right. Anything. Anything but this.
Well, as dank and vile as that idiom was, we get a nice cut around the bridge. Everybody gives a gulp and off they jump. And we're inside the DMA, which looks kind of like the inside of a nebula.
Yeah. It's pretty in its own way.
Yeah. Surprising. This is when Commander Nan suggests a secret second McLaughlin group.
Issue two.
And she briefs Saru and Captain Burnham on a backup plan, a failsafe that Starfleet has put together. Starfleet has identified a Death Star-like weakness in Book's ship ever since the spore drive was installed.
It's a small thermal exhaust port right below the main port.
And if push comes to shove, they may have to photon torpedo Book's ship, destroying him. But the risk is raised that they could set off the bomb if they destroy his ship.
Yeah, someone could set us off the bomb.
Which doesn't seem good.
I thought this was pretty smart contextually, right? Like, if Starfleet is going to install a thing in Book's ship, it's sort of like that question of like installing a backdoor into an iPhone so that it can be unlocked by a government agency. Like, like, it feels a lot like that. And it makes a ton of sense that they wouldn't just, because Book isn't a Starfleet officer and never was,
right,
that they would create some sort of backdoor into his ship.
Are you saying that the Spore Drive 2.0 is like downloading the TikTok app?
I am. I am saying that. That's what I'm saying exactly.
Wow. So nobody loves this idea, but Nan is like, I am prepared to give the order for this if the mission keeps failing the way it failed last time. So
if no one at this table likes this idea, I know a certain bridge officer who will fucking love it. You might have just seen him fall onto the ground after beaming aboard. He's the one with the blue stripe on his comm badge.
Yeah. Very problematic, Reese. Why are you such a big fan of The Punisher all of a sudden? It's kind of a pattern with Michael Burnham that like a unacceptable situation is presented to her and only then does she come up with a way to get around it. And this is when she calls down to Stamets, who she's like, okay, do some math. There is a given amount of the element that the DMA is here to mine in this sector. Given what we know about where it's been and how much it has gathered up in its past presences in various places, figure out how much longer till it moves again. And Stamets gives his classic Starfleet engineer pushback, but we need this information. So that's going to be the deep sea storyline in this episode.
Right.
An episode which I'm not even sure if it has a B storyline.
This turns a fight between Burnham and Nan into a truce.
Yeah.
A truce during which they're going to tell the Admiral of this new great plan they came up with.
They're going to place that call. And meanwhile, we cut over to Book's ship, where Book is really up in his head about the situation, worried about what this means for the people he cares about, the few remaining people he cares about that are still alive.
Tarka's like, look, I'm sorry my security system almost killed a bunch of your friends, but I'm just going to call it like I see it here. This isn't the only time you're going to have to make a choice between your buddies and this mission that for some reason you've decided to go with me on.
Yeah. I've been working on this for 10 years, and even though that seems insane because nobody knew about the DMA before a few weeks ago, and the power source at the center of it is critical to the completion of this mission, at least from my standpoint,
yeah,
I'm not going to let you stand in the way of me finishing it.
Yeah, so maybe get your head in the game, mister. Really going to need you for some reason.
I really believe that Tarka doesn't understand how much he is fucking himself by continuing to place his needs in front of Book as an important consideration.
Yeah. He's going to die having self-owned.
Yeah. Like, I really think that it's possible to read this scene as, like, bad writing that Tarka is giving away the game. But I think that his character has been well-written enough that, like, I believe that this is actually, like, a social blind spot that is fucking him up.
Yeah. He needed a different partner.
This scene really feels like a turning point to me where you can start to see the cracks in Book's willingness to play along.
Right.
And now, like, what it will take is somebody finding a wedge to drive into that crack.
Book, it's me.
So they begin playing a game of Starship Chicken, where the Disco needs to find the center of the DMA, the control device, and get in between Book's ship and it. And there's lots of gambits being played with here. They call it like the Breen maneuver or something. Oh, the Breen gambit.
Right.
That's why the word gambit was in my head. I guess.
Good memory.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
All the while, it really feels like Michael Burnham is looking for any excuse she can not to fire lethal shots at Book's ship. And Nan is kind of like getting increasingly irritated about this. She's like, all right, like at this point, the guy is actively threatening our safety. And I think we can heat up the weapons set to kill.
Yeah. I mean, Burnham is extremely trigger shy.
Yeah.
And Tarka is on Book's ship making the same observation about Book. Like, what are you guys doing here?
It kind of felt like they were flirting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're space battle flirting.
Get a room, you two.
It also felt like when you've got two ships with spore drives and one of the ships has a mission of blocking the other. It's like in checkers where you just like move one piece to one square and the other blocks and then back and then back and then back and then back. Like,
right.
It'll last forever.
Yeah. Playing whack-a-mole when you're a little too drunk.
Yeah, you don't want to play drunk whack-a-mole.
Stamets hard at work on figuring out the math problem. We finally get a look at the DMA controller, which is a really fun design. It kind of looks like the sort of executive desk toy that a Baul might have at the office.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah, he wants to swim up in between those pipes. Everyone gets a react shot here when we see it.
Yeah. It's good. I really like the design of it.
I liked it too. The disco gets there first and Book gets there second.
Yeah. This is when Nan throws Reese the attack pattern for the last ditch destroy Book option. And finally, Reese has met his match in hawkishness. He's like, wait a minute. What are we talking about here? Really? We're going to kill Book?
I mean, he's not so reluctant that he doesn't just hold his hand over the transparent button as soon as it's displayed in front of him. I thought this was a funny bit of business with respect to the screen in front of him, right?
Yeah.
I think it could look silly if there is less information on screen and you see his hand fully.
It's just a big red button icon.
I think you just barely see his hand outstretched there. And that is a funny visual if he's just got to hold his hand out,
ready
to push.
I mean, it's an interesting dilemma because it's like the most violent thing that they can do, but it's sort of like the opposite politically of what he wants to do.
Yeah. Reese is the guy who plays Civ and always goes for domination. He loves launching those nukes, right?
Yeah. Man after my own heart.
Yeah, so do I, really. Nukes are fun in Civilization.
Yeah. And nowhere else.
That's why they won't use nukes anymore, and we won't either.
Disco drops the cloak when Book arrives, and we get some jump around standoffs here.
Yeah.
Does anyone remember how the Disco jumps? Because once they start jumping, it's Stamets and Burnham on the blower talking about like how it's going.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Is Stamets still touching goo?
Is there an acceptable answer other than yes?
No.
I think he's touching goo at this point. He's not getting stabbed in the arms. He's just got like nano globs that he's put his hands in.
It's interesting how this show turned away from its own technology a little bit.
Yeah.
And toward the inter-character drama instead, right?
I think that it would get a little old if you had to show it every single time they went to Black Alert.
I mean, I'm not advocating for that, but I think an insert of some hand and goo is not unwelcome here.
An insert of Michael Burnham rubbing the nubbin on the underside of her chair would have been really nice as well, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, ring that bell every so often. So this is full-on space combat at this point. Like, torpedoes are getting launched. Nan is getting ready to give the order. Book and Tarka are really coming to a point where they're working at cross purposes. When Tarka, like, bangs the console like a drum.
I love how Book's ship has haptic torpedoes. Like, the harder you hit, the more forceful the volley.
The bigger the yield.
Yeah. And this really drops bangers over on the disco. And Nan, like, the camera creeps up into Nan's face, hero shot style. And Nan's like, it's time to burn this book.
Call me George Orwell.
And Reese is like, whoa. I mean, I know a lot of people had some ideas about my leanings here, but
yeah,
even I wouldn't have said that.
So Reese is like, all right, I'm going to push this button, getting ready to push it. Nothing can stop me now. I am going to put my finger on the part of the screen where the button is. And this gives Michael Burnham plenty of time to like look around at everybody on the bridge and make really intense eye contact with them.
If this was the end of Best of Both Worlds, that sound in the orchestra would just be repeating for like an extra 30 seconds.
And instead of Reese getting his finger in contact with that button, Stamets radios up to the bridge and is like, I've done all the math. The math is done. The math is we've got a week before the DMA moves to another part of space.
Right. Which means they've got a pretty long runway for negotiation if they want to take it.
They try to hail Book with this information. He's not picking up the phone. And
yeah.
Michael Burnham and Nan have to walk back into the ready room to have a discussion about this dilemma, because Nan is like, this is the moment. We have to take him out. And Michael Burnham is arguing for there may be room for compromise that can actually like lead to a better outcome here. And seeing this in the black and white way that your people are given to according to Admiral Dad, who voices sort of retrograde racial opinions at Thanksgiving dinner.
This is another version of the two characters in a room talking about their similar experiences as a way to understand each other during a time of crisis.
Yeah.
Like, heavy is the head that has to make a tough call is what they can both agree about. And this is like an Star Trek sensibility.
Totally.
This is the Spock box thing. This is needs of the many.
How many lives can we save when
right.
we do the thing, and which thing leads to the most lives saved?
And Michael Burnham's like, well, this ship doesn't have a warp core like in Wrath of Khan, but it does have a shuttle I can get into.
Yeah.
By myself.
Yeah.
Suggesting that I could sacrifice myself so that, you know, if need be, you could still blow up Book's ship and the weapon and beat it, just leaving me and Book and Tarka as the only casualties here. And that seems like a fair trade.
So Michael Burnham flies up like window to window in a shuttle so that she can have an eye to eye conversation with Book. And she gives him the pitch. Here's the deal. Let's give it a week. We'll do our best to make first contact. And if it doesn't work, or if for some reason first contact, you know, leads to a negative outcome, which it never has in the past, so I don't see how that could be possible.
You have made an enemy today.
You guys can do the bomb. You can blow up the DMA the way you want to. And Book is like seeing the reason here, but you can see Tarka over his shoulder not accepting this, because if first contact works, Tarka loses his power source for quote unquote going home. So this is not a good deal for Tarka.
Your eye finds Tarka in this scene as the third wheel.
Yeah.
And he doesn't ham it up back there the way that I expected.
Yeah.
Because this is both extremely uncomfortable as a third wheel watching a relationship conversation, and also a third wheel watching two people determine whether or not your big plan is going to succeed.
Yeah. He is quick to do the math on this and quick to see that it is no good for him, but it's too late. Book has already made the deal, and Book doesn't really think that Tarka gets to have any input after he installed weird safety devices on his ship without asking that nearly killed members of the Discovery crew.
This is the most predictable outcome that could possibly happen. Like, Tarka has demonstrated an inability to accept someone else making decisions on his behalf.
Yeah.
He's not going to let this slide, and so he beams the weapon into the DMA controller.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit unfortunate that this unfolded the way it did, because Michael Burnham didn't like stick around to make sure they stand down the weapon. She just like flies her shuttle back to the ship.
Yeah.
Trusting that Tarka is going to go along with the thing that Book agreed to.
There's such a pregnancy in showing transit, right?
Yeah.
Because we barely see Burnham drive her shuttle up to book ship, but we luxuriate in the trip home where we experience Tarka's frustration with Book here.
Yeah, Tarka does like a villain monologue the entire time that Michael Burnham's shuttle is flying away.
Yeah.
And then fires up his transporter. And this is a catastrophic fuck up. Michael Burnham beams back onto the bridge like as the situation goes left. The Disco has like barely enough time to jump out of there. This seems like a huge scandal. Like, the Discovery was sent to specifically stop this exact thing from happening. I think this goes to the highest levels of Federation military and political society. Like, I think Rylik needs to resign. I think we need a resignation letter from Admiral, who once seemed like an honorable man, but that veneer has just worn away under any amount of public scrutiny.
I understand this is awkward.
Yeah.
The DMA has been exploded. The thing everybody voted against has happened. And Tarka is the only person that seems happy. Not even Reese seems happy about this.
It's one of those retreat standoffs before Disco finally has to bail. Like, this is actually great bad guy stuff here, because Tarka sets like a 3-second timer on the bomb. Don't have to wait too long for this thing to go off. So Disco bugs out and then books ship and then boom.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that this thing is going to work until it definitely looks like it didn't.
Yeah, because Tarka starts searching for the battery that he is sure is going to have been left behind. And in fact, it has not. The way the DMA was powered was through a source of power on the other end of the wormhole. He was engaged in wishful thinking. He thought he could just get this thing, and he couldn't.
Two things about this moment. One, it was definitely inspired by that scene in Independence Day where they nuke the saucer, and then when the smoke clears, it remains.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely inspired by that. And also, I wish we had talked about this when we were first introduced to the idea of what the DMA does and that it's a boromite harvester or whatever.
Right.
Any civilization with technology advanced enough to make one of these has enough technology to make another, right? Because one boromite harvester is none, and two boromite harvesters are one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're that smart.
It's what we call redundancy.
How could they possibly think that there would only be one of these, and by destroying one, they would have a successful plan?
Well, I think that they thought that the explosion would go back through the wormhole and kill whatever was on the other side of it. But it seems like whoever built this anticipated that as a potential problem.
Right.
So it seems as though Tarka did not get what he wanted, and everybody's going to be so mad at him.
Yeah.
I kind of thought that Nan would be mad at Michael Burnham.
I thought so too. I thought more people would be mad in general.
Yeah.
Like, and that the tone at the end of the episode would just be mad. Mad and disappointed.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not either of those things. Hardly.
Michael Burnham is chilling in her quarters and Nan comes in and is like, hey, like, I would love to, you know, think about reapplying for a job here if anything ever comes open.
I can't believe this.
I want the political fallout. I want the scandal. I want like Rylik standing in that super tall, skinny room getting yelled at by aliens from across the galaxy.
Is the subtext we're not getting from this scene is that Nan knows that Burnham's the only person who could possibly hire her after what's just happened? Luke, my resume is shit out on the open market. I figure you're going to be the only one who I could even ask to hire me. So just keep me in mind.
If I get tired of not having a family back on Barzan.
Yeah.
That's one thing that gets talked over here is that Nan's presence in this timeline is, it's still a secret, like where she came from. So she can't just like walk up and introduce herself and be like, I'm your great, 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 great grandmother.
Right.
That would fuck things up for everyone.
Yeah. She's in all the way or not at all with her relationships, her missions, everything. I was a little confused by her story. Like, did she even have an interaction with them, or did she just sit on a park bench watching her descendants on swing sets and just decide not to engage with them?
Yeah. And then somebody went over to the sign at the gate of the park that said, adults not attending children are not allowed inside the play area, and just tapped it with the back of their finger.
They're not allowed.
But ironically, you're allowed.
Mm. Yeah, you're is the time traveler that is allowed to hang out in your parks. The suggestion here is maybe this isn't forever. Like a lot of characters we like in Star Trek Discovery, it's a hug goodbye or maybe hug see you later.
Yeah.
Speaking of hugs, over in Six Bay, Saru hits up Culber and was like, hey, really appreciated what you said back there in the shuttle. It seems like you really have a good grasp of how to act and think in times of great stress. You know, I'm in one of those right now.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping I can get some advice.
I've been invited on an intercultural date, which obviously can't work. Two people from, you know, different backgrounds, they never get together successfully. So I have to say no. I just have to say no in a way that lets you down easy.
Yeah. Culber is like,
you're being an idiot.
Look at you, man. You think you have a lot of options? You live in a swamp. You have fingers that look like that.
Yeah. Obviously, Trina likes you. You know what, man? Get it, player.
Oh, I would. Like, medically, I do have some advice for you. Maybe skip whatever base it is where there's fingers involved. Is that, like, second base? Skip that base.
I don't know what the kids call them these days.
Don't even think about it in bases. Just avoid using your hands, I'd say.
Just do ganglia stuff for now.
What sucks is Trina really prefers that, which is digital stimulation.
Yeah.
So maybe this is destined to fail.
Hi. Big fan. I have really been enjoying the fourth season of Discovery, but in season 4, episode 9, Rubicon, Saru literally asks his gay friend for relationship advice, and I thought that this show had kind of done a lot to do away with bad stereotypes. Do you have any feelings about this as like a trope that is being used in the show?
Boy, I mean, if you were made uncomfortable by this part, Ben, just wait until the future episode where they go shopping at the clothes replicator together.
I mean, look at the way you're dressed.
Saru needs everything in extra, 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 extra tall.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like Saru's going to go for it.
Yeah.
Culber can be very convincing.
He's a persuasive man. Culber not as stressed out this episode as he was last episode.
I think he's finally got a clean condo now, and that makes all the difference, right?
Yeah. Now that the dot has scrubbed all the cum off the walls.
Yeah. Chiseled it out of all of the areas.
Yeah. It's like one of those extreme detailing videos. Like.
Yeah. Now, you know, you can actually buy these dentist drills, and they are just perfect for digging cum out of tile.
Saru is taking notes about that when he gets called up to the bridge, and they have a transmission from another Starfleet vessel that's been monitoring the space that the DMA was in before Tarka's bomb destroyed it. There's just another DMA. It's exactly what you predicted, Adam.
Yeah.
Somebody that has the resources to buy a shovel has the resources to buy a second shovel.
So weird, right?
Weird.
Lot of eggs on faces at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
Look at my face, Ben. Egg free.
Yeah. You know about redundancy.
I do. Yeah.
But do you like this episode?
The two major logical flaws in this episode are the redundancy of the Boronite harvester. And that having Nan around is fun as a chaperone, but is completely contrary to the stated mission that the Admiral had in keeping people's emotions out of things.
Yeah.
Because the only reason Burnham got 3 or 4 or 5 second chances is because Nan gave them to her.
Right. Nan fucked up.
Yeah.
Michael Burnham did what everybody predicted she would do.
Yeah.
And Nan was there to stand in the way of that.
It's one of those episodes that's beautiful and fun. And again, I'm looking forward to how they're going to get out of this pickle in the next episode. But those two major holes mean that unless you're able to ignore them, I mean, this is a hard episode to love.
Yeah. You hate an episode with a her.
Or.
Especially two hers.
Or.
You know, one her is no hers. Two hers is one her.
We've been saying it for years.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, tough one for me to love. I mean, some strong and fun parts of it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But like when the essential logic of an episode falls apart, it makes it really hard for me to like an episode in totality. What about you?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. Like, I think that those hurls are both things that sort of push Michael Burnham's weaknesses as a captain into the foreground. And like, I think that this is a thing that could be handled in a more interesting way. Like, I was thinking about in Mission Impossible Fallout, how so much of the discussion of like what makes Ethan Hunt so good at his job is that he doesn't care more about the lives of millions than the lives of a member of his team. And in the logic of Mission Impossible, those are two things that are not mutually exclusive because Ethan Hunt always finds a way to succeed in the impossible mission.
Right.
And I feel like that's sort of the kind of character that Michael Burnham is, with a lot more heart. But instead of finding an interesting way to articulate that, it sort of feels like the show keeps kind of running up against that in a way that isn't ideal. And I agree that, like, on balance, most of this episode is fun and exciting and interesting. But like every time she's like, let's not kill Book. Let's not do the horrible thing. It's like, yeah, I want her to not kill Book. I want her to not do the horrible thing. I just want it to be pushed across the finish line in a more interesting way, in a way that articulates her needs as being more valid than all of the reasonable criticisms being leveled against her by people on the bridge.
I'm frustrated when character setups are not paid off, you know, rationally. I'm not asking for predictable outcomes for characters.
Yeah.
But why set things up in the way that they are if characters are going to act against their stated interests, as they do constantly in this episode?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to get to something specific a little later during Shimoda, but like, Nan's whole reason for being in this episode is unrealized because she does not do the thing that she's there to do.
Yeah, that is true. And what also felt really hard to ignore for me in this episode is that, like, the Disco has basically failed almost every mission it's been sent on.
Right. If you're a captain of one of the other super ugly BMW Federation starships that exist in this galaxy now, you have got to be so frustrated by this.
Yeah.
Like, there is a flagship to this fleet right now that is just what? Like, sitting in the garage waiting?
Yeah, it's always plugged in on that glowy cable to Federation HQ.
I mean, an interesting character arc might have been like the captain of that ship.
Yeah.
Being at odds with Michael Burnham. What makes Michael Burnham so deserving of all of these A-story missions? You know, make it more competitive.
Yeah.
There's no competition in this show.
Do you want to see if there's any competition in the Priority One inbox?
Yeah, I could just go on forever, Ben. You're right. Let's do P1s.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Mariana, and it is to Fanny. The message goes like this. I figured I would not be able to control when this comes out, but know that I'm buying this on your birthday. Happy birthday, Fanny. Thank you for being a great friend and always being willing to talk Star Trek with me. May 2022 be an awesome year for you, and perhaps at some point we can catch a live show together. Well, you're in luck, Fanny and Mariana. I hope you're able to catch a live show together in late March, early April.
That would be great.
Where we have a bunch of live shows coming.
Yeah. I love that Mariana called this shot.
Yeah.
Turo hadn't been announced when they bought the message. Now it's announced.
It's time. It's time for Fanny and Mariana to go to this show.
Yeah. Yeah, happy birthday, Fanny. Sorry we missed your birthday by a couple of weeks. We have another Priority One message here from Ramon LP4, and it's to Ben and Adam. It goes like this. Happy New Year, guys. 2022 resolution. Send pod scarves. Done! By the way, I heard that your selection process for a new producer not only involved pain sticks, but also auditions, and that while Wendy's Sulu and Crystalline Entity reads were impressive, it was her Kevin reading that really killed. If true, can you please release the Uxbridge tapes? Thanks.
Ramon LP4. Wow, like so many times P1's pimp us into character work. Now it's Wendy.
Yeah, now Wendy has to do a character. Let's see
what
she does.
This is a shame I tried so hard to keep you from learning. I am a doubt.
All right.
That was a very shitty Kevin, Wendy. That was the worst Kevin I've ever heard.
That's why we do Kevin and our producer does not.
Yeah. We do Kevin. Wendy does credits.
Wow. Thank you, Ramon and Mariana, for those P1s. If you'd like to get a P1 on the show, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron and set it up.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! I think I'm going to give it to Reese for talking politics at work twice. He did it again after the first time. He did not see the downsides after the first time. I mean, if we're talking about characters with cracks developing in their relationships, it's not just Tarka and Book. It's also Reese and Bryce. And I felt more could have been done with the like brutal irony of Reese being asked to be the person to kill Book when he agrees with what Book is doing. I kind of felt like that could have been pushed into the B or even A story. Like it was a thread, but it didn't really feel like a fully realized story. And if like we knew more about Reese and more about why he is so fired up about this, I feel like they could have like actually done something kind of interesting with that. And all we can do is wonder about it as written. So
yeah.
Maybe they'll find a way to tease that out in a future episode. I'd be really curious to see about that.
Yeah.
How about you?
My Edward Larkin is a little bit meta. A little bit meta-mate, if you will. It's Tarka for not being Shimoda enough. I really could have used mad scientist vibes from him a little more, like in a way that were suggested for him up until now.
Yeah.
A little more desperation in a weird way, like a little more Joker.
Ooh, yeah.
I could have used from him because I want to take him seriously as a threat, but it feels like for a lot of this season, the emotional and conflict margins have been avoided. And we're like in this very safe place in the middle with all of our conflicts and our expectations. And I really think the Tarka character was, I mean, there's still opportunity for this. There's still some episodes left, but I'd like to be surprised more by him as a chaos agent because I think that's what he's there to do. And he's just not chaotic enough for me. So, I mean, I think for that reason, maybe this is more of an inspirational Edward Larkin. Like, be a more of a chaos agent, Tarka. Like, really be the threat that I think you're capable of.
Yeah. Contreland in season 2 was such an arch villain, such a mustache twirling, I'm going to do an evil thing villain.
Do you think that kind of forced this play onto Tarka? Like, we don't want to go 10 out of 10 with this character anymore?
Well, I just think that like the fact that he has motives that like he is prepared to let a lot of people die to achieve his goals, but people dying is not the goal the way it was with Contreland. And so I feel like he is a very different kind of heavy. But I agree that like if he was more erratic and more unpredictable, you know, we saw him beaming the bomb into the controller a mile away in this episode. And if it had seemed like he had backed off and then done it anyways or something like that, it would have been more exciting, I think.
I mean, or if it came from nowhere, I mean, and this doesn't count as nowhere because this would have been telegraphed too, but if Reese hit the button before being told.
Yeah.
Like, truly make it chaotic.
Chief of the Watch, hit the button.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of those episodes, Ben, I think you can agree that really was good fodder for conversation.
Yeah, I agree.
A lot to chop up here.
I hope the next episode is as well. We don't know the title yet or a description, but maybe Wendy will, and we'll have to have her tell us all about it in the credits.
I think we're all thankful she's doing the credits in her own voice and not Kevin Uxbridge.
I thought her Uxbridge was good.
Nope. Very bad.
Jeez.
This is like you ever go back and listen to the Survivors episode of Greatest Gen, like our initial Kevin Uxbridge was bad. It yeah, got better.
That's true. I don't think it got better. It just got more distinctive.
The Greatest Discovery is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, produced and edited by Wendy Pretty. Our music is by Adam Ragusea. Check out his YouTube cooking channel. And on Instagram and Twitter, you can find us at Greatest Trek. Those accounts are managed by the wonderful Bill Tilly. We'd love it if you would recommend this show to a friend or leave a 5-star review online. You can also check out the many great fan-run communities where you can connect with other friends of DeSoto. Those are on Discord at DrunkShimoda.com, on Facebook, and on Reddit at r/GreatestGen. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more of The Greatest Discovery.
If you yell Kevin 3 times, Kevin appears.
Hello, Captain Picard. You rang.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.